You're listening to Campfire Conversations, brought to you by Three Rivers Land Trust. Connected to the land, committed to conservation.
Happy Thursday, everybody. No.
No, we should edit that out.
We're not going to post this on Thursday. Sorry, Addy, you'll have to take out the first 10 seconds. Hey, what's up, everybody? We're down here at the podcast studio at Backcountry and Beyond in downtown Salisbury. Before we get into the meat of the podcast today, I wanted to give you all a quick update. Backcountry and Beyond has been a longtime loyal supporter of the Land Trust, so we always love to give them some free airtime whenever we can. And so right now they are, Jeff was just telling us that he is really working on expanding his women's clothing line. That's kind of a new space for them. They've got some awesome new arrivals, some new spring stuff coming in with the weather warming up. It's definitely worth coming down here and checking out, getting yourself geared up for the spring. Also, if you know anything about the retail world, when they're bringing in new lines and bringing in new stuff, that also means the clearance racks are filling up. So lots of great opportunities to get outfitted for spring here at Backcountry Beyond in downtown Salisbury. All right, so today on the podcast, we have a TRLT staff member, Emily Calicutt, with us. Her and I are going to do a little bit of chatting about birds. Emily is a self-described bird nerd. You guys know this about me. I love to, you know, I've been bird hunting, waterfowl hunting for about 20 years now. My suspicion is that her knowledge on the subject far outpaces my own, and we're going to see if we can't confirm that and give you guys a few laughs and make me look dumb in the process. So here we go, introducing Emily.
Yeah, hey, it's been a long time since I've been on, so good to be back on the podcast.
So tell us a little bit about you went to NC State, you studied
fisheries, wildlife, and conservation biology.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So I graduated from there in May of 2020, and really a lot of the coursework there is focused on like wildlife biology and conservation biology, so a lot of ecology and life history stuff, and
okay,
kind of turned me into the self-prescribed bird nerd that I am.
Nice. And you did some work on refuges. Fill us in a little bit on that. You've told me some about it, but for our listeners who haven't heard, you worked primarily what refuges?
Yeah, so right after I graduated from NC State, I moved to Maryland to Patuxent Wildlife Refuge,
okay,
which if you know much about wildlife refuges, it's kind of like the research refuge. They do a lot of wildlife research there. It's actually where they did a lot of the sandhill crane and whooping crane like breeding and rearing programs.
Okay.
Unfortunately, all that had kind of ended by the time I got there, but a really exciting research area. And I managed the hunting program on the refuge. So there were me and a couple other folks, and we were in charge of all the hunting stuff, collecting biological data, you know, aging deer, sexing and aging waterfowl,
yep,
and keeping harvest logs.
Yeah, so Emily has said she's got a lot of wings from her time at the refuge, whole lot of wings at the house that she kept, which is something that, like, you know, I would love to tell a story on myself right now. I like to keep, you know, keepsakes, things from the field. It was funny when I interviewed here, my wife asked me, you know, she's always like, where did you get that turtle shell? What is that doing in our house? What is this, a thigh bone from what kind of animal did this come from? Where did we get this femur? And I'm just finding stuff in the woods, bringing it home because I think it's cool. I've got a fully intact skull from a doe that I found. And when I interviewed here, you know, I went home, Whitney was like, so what was it like? What were the offices like? I'm like, well, I stuck my head in a few of the offices, and most everyone that I could see had at least one turtle shell or some sort of like piece of an animal that they had found in the woods and saved and brought it. And she kind of cut me off and was like, you need to do whatever you can and try to go to work there. That sounds like your kind of place. You'll be very at home there.
Yeah. I got lucky that on the refuge, that's where all of the, like, when hunters are asked to send in waterfowl wings on the East Coast, they go to the Patuxent Refuge.
Oh, wow. So you got them all over.
Yeah. So USGS, the station, is there. And so I got to work with the biologist on staff there to process all of the, like, hunter harvest send-ins. And so you only have to send in one wing. And so anytime the hunter would send in the duplicate, I got to keep
duplicate. So what was the most
freezer at my parents' house? They don't love that. But
no, I've got some of that. I've got a couple of wood duck wings, some woodcock wings, and a few quail wings in the freezer. And I've learned to just keep those in the downstairs freezer because she checks there less often, and, you know, is less likely to be like, what kind of wing is this? Why is this next to our children's chicken nuggets? You know, like, come on, man. What we thought we would do today is Emily has prepared some questions to kind of test my knowledge. So we're going to get into that now. And then at the end, I will update you guys on some things we have coming up in the spring. A lot of stuff we've been talking about, but we've got some new information to share around raffles and upcoming events and all that fun stuff. So, Emily, I'm going to turn it over to you. Hit me with your best shot. Let's see how little the bird hunter actually knows.
Yeah, so we're going to start off with what I think will probably be the harder questions for you, which are a little less game bird focused and more kind of migratory songbirds in general.
Okay.
And then we'll transition into the waterfowl stuff. And then I'm going to hit you with some calls
okay.
and some songs, and we'll see how well you
see
do
what I
there.
Can do. All right, I'm ready.
Yeah. So I'm going to start you out with an easy one.
Yeah.
In North Carolina, what are kind of the two main songbird migration times? When can we expect to see a lot of those, like, neotropical migrants coming through North Carolina?
Okay. I'm going to say fall and spring.
Can you be a little more specific with that?
All right. I hear you. So I'm going to say around, are you looking for, like, when you say specific month?
Couple months, yeah.
Okay. October, November, and April, May.
Yeah, you got it.
Nice.
Good job, Will.
I almost went March,
April. 1 point for you.
There we
go.
It's been a cold March, so I was like, no, they're not really moving right now. I hadn't seen, because I, you know, look in the sky, I'm always watching. I hadn't noticed many birds moving north yet. I think it's because it's been chilly.
Yeah, so it's kind of April, May, and September, October, kind of into November. Kind of the main songbird migration times. You know, they're either coming up here to breed or they're going back home to escape the cold.
Yep.
And so those are kind of the two main peaks. So in kind of the songbird world, most of them fall in the order Passiformes, which is kind of your neotropical migrants, your songbirds. How many species of songbirds do you think are in that order?
We're talking about, and this is not North Carolina, we're talking just
we're talking
total.
All
how many
over
species?
The world.
Oh gosh. I'm thinking thousands, but that's a wide range. I'm going to say 3,500.
3,500?
Yeah.
So double that.
Wow. Okay, so not
there
close.
There are at least 6,500 that we know of. You know, new species are kind of being separated out constantly.
Yeah.
We, you know, we may think that there's a species, oh, maybe they just look a little different in different parts of the world, and the more research that goes on, those get split into completely separate species. There are about 140 different families that those species fall in. So when we talk about songbirds, there's a lot of range within that. You know, they're all over the globe. Pretty much every continent gets visits from songbirds. And so they're pretty wide ranging.
Is there anywhere in the world where songbirds just don't exist outside of the poles?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. They're pretty much everywhere has a bird.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, of all of those 6,500 species, about what percentage of you of that do you think is migratory?
Oh, man. I feel like this is designed to stump me, and that's probably going to give me a wrong answer, but I'm going to guess 35%.
You're so close.
Yeah?
About 40% of that is migratory.
That's impressive. See, because I felt like that was my initial reaction to that was like, it's got to be 80% or north. That's what I'm sitting here thinking while you were finishing your question. But yeah, that's the SAT prep, you know,
And
still drawing on it.
And in kind of this context for, you know, what percentage of these species migrate, we're kind of thinking, you know, long migration, not like, you know, a species that might live in higher elevations coming down south. That can also be considered a migration, but I'm kind of framing it more as like a spring.
Yeah, multiple states.
Like a spring up north, a winter down south.
Different climates.
Migration.
Yeah,
yeah.
Got it.
But yeah, very good. I'm impressed.
Okay.
Okay, this we're getting a little harder now.
All right.
So, we all know that birds have feathers.
Yes.
That's a thing we know, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are six major types of feathers.
Oh, God.
Can you name them?
No. All right. Flight feathers.
Go a little broader than that.
Okay. Types of feathers.
Mm-hmm. So think about, like, when you're a bird and you've just hatched, what's your, like, main purpose of those feathers?
Warmth.
Yeah. So what are those?
So down feathers.
Yep. That's one.
Okay. Pin feathers?
That can fall within a category. Yeah.
Okay.
Keep going.
Golly. I've just recently started tying flies and like saving feathers and trying to work that in, so I should know more about this, but I got to tell you, I'm stumped.
Okay. So we for sure got down feathers.
Yeah.
That's one.
I almost said that first and I was like, no, but yeah. That can't be a category. That's like, you know, anyway, so that shows you how little I know.
Yeah. So those are really important for insulation to keep hatchlings warm. There's also another category of down feathers called powder down, which is what a lot of the species that live in colder climates have.
Okay.
Those are the ones that kind of like disintegrate if you touch them, if you've ever seen those.
Mm-hmm.
They're also contour feathers. So those are your flight feathers, your wing and your tail feathers that have that vein running through the middle.
Got it. Okay.
And then there's also what are called semi-plumes. So these are another type of feather that's used for insulation. They're not quite a down, but they're fluffier and a little less rigid than other
feathers.
Where
would those be on the body, a semi-plume?
Not on the wings and the tail, kind of along, you know, the main body.
Okay, like midsection. Mm-hmm. All right.
And then they're also a type of feather called a phyloplume. And these are really cool. These are basically airflow sensors. So they're usually on the head and the wings.
Okay.
And they help regulate airflow. So they're, you know, as birds are flying, they have a better sense of like what kind of forces are acting on them.
Now, this is fascinating. So tell me more about like this. You're talking real time adjustment of feathers to react to external conditions in flight. Wow. What would cause like what are the changes that are made in flight and what would be the purposes of those? Like to move more air or less air to create more lift?
Right. And so like if you're, you know, they're flying and it's in a super windy day, they know like what kind of external forces are acting on them and how they can adjust to regulate that, which is very, very cool. And there are also the last one is called a bristle. So if you've ever seen like fly catchers that have those almost like cat whisker looking feathers coming off their face.
Yeah.
And they kind of work like sonar and stuff in bats. They're used to find insects close to them.
Okay.
Which is very cool. They're a modified feather, but it looks like a whisker.
So it's almost like a lateral line on a fish. They're like sensing vibrations and
yeah, that's right. Sometimes they'll be called like vibrissae, but bristle feathers works. And so
okay.
Yeah, I just think that's so cool.
That is really cool. And so when you said, so I answered pin feathers, you said that can be a category. That's obviously not the name of a type of feather, but where would that
Yeah, I think
fit?
That would be most closely to like a veined or a contour feather.
Okay.
So like one that has a blood source that, you know, has that like stiff mid vein running through it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So when I said that, were you thinking like writing pin?
Or just like a stiff.
And this probably isn't even what they're called. Mm-hmm. What I'm talking about is like when you're plucking like waterfowl to dress for the table. It's like you pluck and then there's something left behind. You almost have to like scorch or singe to kind of.
Right. I think that would
be semi down or down.
Right.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah.
Got it. Well, there you go. I've been calling them pin feathers my whole life. Had no idea.
And I'm sure like, you know, that everything has multiple different names. These are just kind of like, I was going back through my ornithology class notes last night, helping me put some of these together. So these are like textbook terms or what most of
these
that
would be the correct term. Yeah. I mean, yeah, whatever the local vernacular is kind of varies from place to place.
All right, so this is my last songbird question,
okay.
But it applies to birds in general. So with feather colors, there are kind of two main like sources of color within feathers.
Oh,
do you know what that comes from?
Oh, I know that diet can affect flesh color, especially in fish. I don't think that's it, but I'm going to say diet because I can pull nothing else from my brain right now. No.
So to give...
Is it an external factor or is it internal?
Both.
Okay.
There's one of each.
So I'm not totally wrong.
Yeah. So there are what are called biochromes. So those are like melanin and carotenoids, like the same thing that give like human skin
and
color.
Hair, all that fun stuff. Yeah.
That is one way that birds can have their feather color. It kind of depends on the species, which category you have. The second one is actually structural. So it's like the actual shape of the keratins themselves in the feathers provide the color. So they're basically prisms that refract light in different ways.
Reflecting certain spectrums of light. Wow.
So these are the birds that you see that have those like iridescent blues and greens. So like ruby-throated hummingbirds, those like purple on their throat. All those birds that have that really iridescent color, that's structural. That's not like a genetic color.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is
I had no idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's insane. I've got a bluebill on my wall from a hunt with a past dog that is a cherished memory. One of my favorite things to do is to, like, when people see it, they're like, you know, what is that? I'm like, it's a bluebill. Down east, folks call them blackheads. But it's kind of funny because if you kind of, I'll tell them to start at one side and walk 180 degrees around the mount and look at the head. And by the time you get about midway and start going to the back, I guess it's those keratin structures. It shows you purple, green, blue, all these colors that just at first glance aren't there.
Yeah. So all of that is just light refracting through those structures. Huh. So like if there was not light to penetrate those, that color would not exist.
Wow.
Whereas like biochrome sourced feather colors, like that color is there in the actual fibers, but with those,
I have no idea. Yeah, I wish y'all could see my face right now because she's explaining that. I'm sitting here slack jawed for like the last 35 seconds, just like, oh my gosh.
It's so cool.
Wow.
I just, you know, it's fascinating how all of that just happens. It's there.
Man.
And we've got people smart enough to figure out how it works.
Well, it's interesting too. It's like that old saying, you know, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody's around to hear it, doesn't make a sound. Well, it's like without light, the color is different. So what color is it really? Man, that, yeah, you could unpack that for a long time. We won't make y'all sit here and listen to all that. That's
get
probably
a philosopher on here.
Yeah,
to
best
talk
done
about
over
that.
A couple beers out of office at some point. Wow. I had no idea.
Yeah. Super cool. Okay, you ready for some more waterfowl-related questions?
Yeah, hit me.
So, how many major molts or plumage cycles will, like, a mallard go through in its first year of life? So, we all know that all birds molt, some more than others, in a mallard's first year of life, so the year it hatches, how many different molts will it go through?
My guess is three.
You're close.
Close?
It's five.
It's five?
Yeah.
What are the, so here's, I was thinking three. My thought was going from like, I'm thinking about like an immature drake morphing into a mature, fully plumed drake. You know, say he's born in the spring. He is a green head by January. And then come March, he's back to like his, is that, when do they molt?
So when you were hatched or when the duck hatches, they have that natal down.
Okay.
So they'll molt all of that off. Okay. Into their juvenile plumage.
So I missed one on the front end. Got it.
And then from your juvenile plumage, you go into like your basic adult plumage. Then after that, you breed again into your alternate plumage, your non-breeding.
So alternate, that would be like the summertime look. Got it.
And then there's also a supplemental molt. So this is happens usually somewhere in between one of these phases where they're replacing those feathers that get damaged or worn. So that was a little bit of a trick one.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So it's like that, so almost like shark's teeth. If a feather is damaged or worn, they can just, their body knows to replace it.
Right.
Wow. That's amazing.
So that's, and if you think like energetically, that takes a lot of work.
I can,
to replace all of those feathers. And so that's why, especially where you've got like in breeding grounds, habitat is so important to have like high quality food.
Yeah.
In those areas, because that's very energetically expensive.
Yeah, I imagine there's a big calorie deficit after you replace all your feathers. So those are the five. So I missed two. All right. I added a third because I was like, I only know that there's, you
breeding,
know, summer and winter.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's all. When he's fully plumed or he's not. Wow. Okay. There you go. Learn something new every day. This is amazing. All right. What's next?
So in North America, we have kind of the four main waterfowl flyways.
Okay.
Can you name them?
Atlantic.
Yep.
Mississippi, Central, and Pacific.
Very good.
Yeah. I've only ever hunted two of them.
Yeah. So that's, yeah, you got it.
So before we go to the next question, this is something I've read recently. I was actually discussing this yesterday on the way to Wilmington to pick up our Jeep for the raffle with Matthew. East-west migration. I feel like I've seen some information out, like, are, do birds trade between flyways? Or if a bird is born in the Atlantic Flyway or Mississippi Flyway, do they stay on that north-south kind of general trajectory for their whole life?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's typically the case. I think, you know, we have instances where, like, we'll get a bird that's not typically found here that is, like, followed the wrong group or hit a weird air current and ends up here. But typically it's that north-south. They stay kind of in the same general flyways. Again, not a waterfowl expert, but that's kind of my understanding.
Okay. That makes sense. For some reason, I felt like I don't know. I know less about it than I thought I did.
The Mississippi and the Atlantic, you know, those are not very far apart. So I think there's some mixing there, but I don't know that we have Pacific birds flying across the continent to get.
So
here.
A couple years ago when I read about a cinnamon teal at Cape Island in South Carolina, how mm-hmm. would that bird, one gets lost? Is it kind of like when Eurasian collared doves came over from the Caribbean and now they're here, they just catch a tailwind and end up in the wrong spot,
right.
but they
or
get happy? And
could be a population of cinnamon teal that has established itself somewhere here. Somebody has released birds and now they're here, so they're migrating along this flyway.
It's when somebody every now and then, I feel like it's every couple of years, I saw one out of South Carolina this year, a mandarin duck shows up on somebody's strap.
And sometimes things just get a little lost and they end up where they're not supposed to be.
Well, that's every time I see one of those, I'm like, that's got to be somebody's pet. Like, there's no way there's a huntable wild population mandarin ducks on the East Coast.
Right. It's all gets a little tricky when you're following air currents and relying on navigation internally. So all of that can get a little off kilter sometimes.
Makes sense.
The team at Montgomery Community College in Troy invite you to get to know their taxidermy program. For decades, MCC has been helping taxidermy enthusiasts explore their industry as either a hobby or an exciting career option. Students of all ages and abilities can participate in day or evening classes and explore this craft in either mammal or fowl classes. Past projects include deer, beaver, fox, coyote, wolf, swan, duck, turkey, and more. Taxidermy is considered one of MCC's Heritage Crafts programs. Other specialty programs include gunsmithing, hunting and shooting sport management, forest management technology, and pottery. Visit montgomery.edu to see course descriptions and explore the exciting world of taxidermy for yourself.
All right, sorry, we got off track.
Can you explain the difference between a dabbling duck and a diving duck?
I can tell you a few differences. I'm not sure I can thoroughly explain it. The major difference would be diving to feed versus tipping to feed.
Right.
And the water depth that they look for, right?
Right.
Diet is probably a big one. I would imagine dabbling ducks are mostly aquatic invertebrates and vegetation, where diving ducks are more like fish, mussels, things that are down on the bottom.
You got it.
Yeah. That's why we don't like to eat diving ducks, because they generally are a little more fishy. Yeah. It depends on where they've been.
Yeah.
Sometimes ringnecks will get in a cornfield that somebody flooded too deep. They can be pretty tasty. But outside of that, yeah.
So building off of that, what is the ideal water depth for dabbling ducks?
It's less than we call them puddle ducks for a reason. I'm going to say less than 12 inches.
Yeah, kind of less than 18 inches. Okay. That's kind of the rule of thumb. And all of the waterfowl classes I've taken, one of the things the professors love to hammer down on is you build and flood impoundments for ducks, not outboard motors.
Right.
And so not for outboard motors and waders. It's shallow, shallow water is kind of the ideal source, because again, they're tipping up to feed, so they've got to be able to reach what's on the bottom to get those tubers and roots and invertebrates.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. I've heard some of that. I've actually heard complaints before about mismanagement of impoundments that get flooded too deep, and then people wonder why they only see ringnecks in their impoundment. It's like, well, those are the only ducks that can get to the food in there.
Exactly.
The rest of them, they probably landed once or twice and couldn't get any food and went on somewhere else.
Exactly. So we've talked a little bit about migration before, but do you know kind of the main internal factors for waterfowl that influence their desire to migrate? Or the internal clues that tell them it's time to start migrating?
I think I know this, and I feel like I'm probably going to, just like with the east-west migration thing, find out that whatever my sources of information are not correct. Okay, so I feel like in the past, what we thought was it was all about temperature.
So this is internal, things that happen within the duck.
Golly. No, I have no idea.
So there are a couple. Kind of one of a big factor is they have to be able to fly. So they have to have finished that pre-migration molt where that plumage changes.
Okay.
They lose their flight feathers during that. So they have to have completed that molt so that their ability to fly is back.
So when they spend the summer in prairie potholes up in, Canada or the Dakotas, they literally are there. They're on the ground. They're not, can they fly short distances, or like a chicken, they just can't?
Yeah, it kind of depends a little bit species to species, but for the majority of species, they're going to lose all of those flight feathers within a couple days.
Okay.
So that they get them all back within a couple days.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's a quicker process than I thought. That makes sense.
Yeah, usually kind of It can vary species to species, so yeah. I don't want to say a range. But yeah, so having they have those flight feathers back. Yeah. That's one. The second is they have to have the like nutrient stores to be able to do it. They've got to be in good body condition.
Makes sense. Got to have fat reserves built up.
Exactly. And then kind of the last major influence is a German word. It's called Zugenruhe.
Okay.
Which basically means like restlessness and anxiety. They just like, they get really restless. They're like, we have got to go.
Huh.
Yeah, which
I mean, I know the feeling. Yeah,
exactly. I think it's kind of a feeling everybody's, you know, if you've got a big trip coming up and you know you've got to get up early and you're like, oh my God, I just want to get on the road. I want to go.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Huh.
It has a word, Zugenruhe.
I love those German words. Yeah. They got a good word for everything. I think my favorite one is Schadenfreude. I have a friend, sidebar time, that works for a German company, and he taught me that word. And I was like, what does it mean? He's like, it means to take pleasure in another's misfortune. And that was like, I was like, man, I'm telling on myself, and I'm not necessarily, this is maybe not the part of my personality that I'm the proudest of, but I can enjoy some Schadenfreude from time to time. I'm not gonna lie. Like, slapstick comedy is right up my alley.
Yeah, there always seems to be a word for whatever you're looking for.
Yep. All right, so external factors, because that's what I was about to answer. Was that the next one?
It can be.
Okay, so I think, I want to know if I'm right about this. I used to always think, and I feel like the prevailing sort of knowledge within the community of waterfowl hunters, well, it was all temperature driven. You're looking for a hard freeze and a big north wind to blow them down. And I'm sure they, you know, I know they use tailwinds to migrate, but I feel like they, in recent years, what we're learning is that it's much more influenced by photo period. Right? Like it's length of day.
Day length is a big one. You know, weather conditions certainly have an impact.
Yeah.
You know, if there's a really hard snow really early in the season, that's going to start sending things moving, because another big factor in that is food availability. If all
the
food's under
snow,
if they can't get to it, they've got to move. And so, photo period is kind of one of the major things, but then weather and temperature certainly impact that too.
I've kind of really been fascinated in the past, I'd say 10 years, in learning about distance of migration and like the amount of miles that a duck can cover in a day. You know, I feel like it's, you know, in the past we thought that they're moving maybe 50 miles at a time. And, you know, what we've kind of found out with, I know, and I've seen some Ducks Unlimited articles around GPS trackers on ducks. And tell me if you think, if this is incorrect, like flying state to state on a daily basis, like roosting in flooded timber in Arkansas and flying to Louisiana coastal marshes to feed and going back and roosting in the evening, like covering hundreds of miles in one flight just at a clip.
Yeah, I'm
that's insane.
I don't know those numbers off the top of my head, but yeah, certainly they can travel really long distances in not a ton of time.
Golly. Mm-hmm. To be able to get up and move like that, that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah. So speaking of like kind of distance, we always think about the length that the birds travel. You ever thought about altitude?
No, but I want to know more about this, because I feel like I am suspicious that at times on really clear days when I'm out hunting, I've told buddies before, like, there are groups that are like way high and they're all moving north to south and they're not stopping here. But I keep thinking like, those are ducks. I know those are ducks. My friends will be like, you're crazy. This stop, like this wishful thinking. It's just been a slow morning. You're seeing things that you want to see that aren't necessarily there.
So do you know what the highest altitude flying migratory waterfowl is?
What the highest altitude is?
Or the species that flies at the highest
altitude. Yeah. I'm going to say, is it a tundra swan?
No.
Because that's the biggest one. So that was like, what is it?
It's actually the bar-headed goose.
Okay.
Do you want to take a crack at how high up in miles?
Doing some quick math in my head, 5,280 feet. I'm going to say 2.5 miles.
5.5 miles.
What in the world?
Isn't that insane?
So 20,000, like in commercial airliner.
Yeah.
Wow.
So they have some really special like adaptations that let them do this. So I don't know, I'll let you take a guess. What would you need if you're going
to
fly?
It's got to be something to do with lungs, right? It's got to be something to do with air pressure and being able to breathe.
Yeah. So they have really big lungs so they can hold on to that oxygen. They also have a really high ventilation rate within their lungs.
What does that
mean? So they're taking in a lot of, I'm going to embarrass myself. It basically means they can take in a lot of oxygen and hold on to it.
Okay.
So they have like a greater higher blood oxygen concentration. They also have more mitochondria in flight muscles.
Okay.
To help keep those muscles pumping and provide more energy.
Hmm.
Isn't that so cool?
I mean, 20,000 feet. I mean, plus, I mean, 5 miles, that's more like 25,000, 30,000. Golly, that's up there.
Yeah.
I mean, that's higher than Mount Everest.
Yeah.
That's insane. So the barheaded goose, I have never heard of this species. Where do they live? Are they living around here?
I believe they are more in the like European flight paths. I'm gonna think about it so I don't embarrass myself.
Got it. So yeah, that's, I mean, I,
yeah,
I
so
cannot
like
imagine.
Central Asia.
Yeah.
So we don't really get them here.
We're not going to see them here, right. But yeah. What's the North American waterfowl? What's the highest? Do you know?
I don't know that off the top of my head.
I would have to guess snow geese. I feel like that's what I always see.
It's going to be some sort of goose species would be my guess.
Well, is there a body size related thing? You know, like small planes can only go so high, but bigger planes can go higher.
You've
got
to like have the muscle and the lung capacity to be able to get up that high.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hmm. Man. 30,000 feet. That's insane.
Yeah. And so if you're a bigger species, you can have a bigger energy stores. Yep. And so you can have what you need to fly further and higher.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right. This is my last question.
All right.
I'm going to end you on an easy one. Make you feel good about yourself again.
All right.
So if you harvest a duck and you want to know if it's an adult or a juvenile, how can you tell that based off of the feathers? Say it's probably a hatchier bird. It's already gone into its like breeding plumage,
mm-hmm.
but you want to know if it's adult or a first year bird.
So I feel like I was just getting ready to answer incomplete plumage, and I think you just ruled that out because bird would be well into its first year. I'm thinking there's got to be something to do with flight feathers because those are replaced late in that first year. You just told me that, so there's got to be some sort of marking on like the speculum or something that would tell you.
So you can look at wing and tail feathers.
Okay.
And at the end of the feather, there's going to be a V-shaped notch pointing down into the feather. That's a juvenile bird. That's where they've lost that fuzzy down feather tip.
Okay.
Has broken off. And so the adult birds are going to have that fully formed.
It's going to be rounded
feather,
on the edge.
Rounded
pointed. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the juveniles have a V-shaped notch.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
I've never thought to look for that before, but now I'm going to be checking every duck. Because I would suspect that, you know, we all think we're better sportsmen than we are, right? Like, you find out how little you know more often than, I know I do, more often than I would care to admit. And I would suspect that most birds that I'm able to fool with my calling and decoy spreads are probably not very experienced. So, like, I'm going to have to start looking closely at that and see how many juvenile birds I'm fooling versus how many, like, mature adults I'm able to pull one over on.
Let me know when you figure that out. I'd be interested to hear what
I mean, I have
about.
A pretty, you know, a strong suspicion. But, yeah, next season we'll do an update on that come November or December. All right, so you said now we got some calls, the audio portion.
Yeah, are you ready for this?
Music quiz, yeah, hit me.
I'm going to play a call. You tell me what you think.
All right. Mallard drake.
Very good.
Nice.
Let me get species number two.
Sorry, I spoke too soon. I'll wait for you to stop them next time.
Oh, no, you don't have to. Keep going. All right, number two.
It's my favorite. That's a wood duck.
Very good.
It's a hen, right? That sounded like a hen squealing.
Yeah, I think you're right on that one. It doesn't specify.
Ah.
All right. I'm giving you another softball. All right, I'm going to give you another one. Same species.
Oh, yeah. Woodcock.
I was going to be
the paint.
So disappointed if you missed
that
one.
Was that first one a woodcock?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I was going to say teal. I'm so glad I kept my mouth shut.
All right. This next one is not a migratory bird, but one that I love. Let me give you another one. Same species. You probably see a lot of them when you're duck hunting.
Yes. No, I've heard that. Golly, I know that call. I've heard that so many times.
I'll give it to you again.
I'm stumped, man.
Belted kingfisher.
Ah, yes. I see them all the time. I love watching those birds work. Golly, I should know that. That makes me angry.
All right, this next one is going to be tricky.
Okay.
This is a migratory warbler. Tell me which species you think it is.
All right. I'm going to get the name wrong, but is yellow somewhere in the name?
No.
No? Okay. Well, no, I have no idea.
Black and white.
Black and white. Is there a warbler that is yellow?
Yeah, there are a lot of them.
And because I feel like, okay, this was last day of the season maybe 3 years ago, and I was like sitting in a swamp, and these little yellow birds were like hopping from top of plant to top of plant. And I was like, that's not a goldfinch because I've never seen those in the swamp. I know they don't really hang out around water. And it was some sort of warbler.
Sorry. Okay.
Is there one that lives around like in the same place as a wood duck's like?
Yeah, so let me play this next one and see if it sounds familiar to you.
It's not a cardinal. Carolina wren? No.
So this is a prothonotary warbler. Okay. So they like hang out a lot over rivers and places like that, and they're yellow. So if you're
that's probably the one I was seeing. Okay.
And they're migratory, so they're coming through in about a month and a half.
When we finish this, I need to know where you're getting all these sounds, because like I want to like up my knowledge on these songs, because everyone you've played sounds familiar, but I can't name it for the life of me.
All right, I'm gonna give you another softball.
That is the bird that I am going to be chasing next. That is a mourning dove.
Very good. All right.
And they actually, I learned this past season, they will respond to calls. I was like buying some stuff. I think I needed another set of mojo wings. So I was on Amazon looking at dove hunting stuff, and they like, hey, you might want this too. And it was a dove call, like a mourning dove call. And I was like, it was like $19.99, so I threw it in the cart. Yeah, but I'm thinking to myself, like, I've never heard of anybody doing this.
Yeah, I'm not either.
Anyway, the second day of opening weekend, so it was Monday morning this past season, I'm sitting out early morning, like went 30 minutes before sunrise, just because I've been waiting a long time every time dove hunting season gets here, so I'm always excited. I'm out there early, and it was slow, and I hadn't seen any birds for like the first hour, and looked down in my bag when I went to grab something to eat, like, well, there's that call I bought. Let's see if this worked. And I hit it a few times, that exact same call you just played. And sure enough, within, I'd say, 5 minutes, there were three came from behind me, you know, from wherever they were roosted in some long leaves behind where I was sitting, landed right in the field.
Oh, that's cool.
So I was like, I guess that's a pretty small sample size, so I can't exactly say that worked. But we'll keep trying.
We'll see if
it works
again.
Yeah, we'll report back in September and let you guys know.
All right. This is probably one you're going to know, not an uncommon bird. Probably see it in your backyard all the time.
Is that a tui?
That's a cardinal.
That's a cardinal?
That's a cardinal.
And I got it wrong. The other one, I mean, golly, the other one you played, I was like, well, it's not a cardinal because I know that call. Yeah. Obviously, I was wrong about that too. So.
A lot of people like to say like laser gun, like a Star Wars laser gun for cardinals.
That's probably the most embarrassing incorrect answer for me so far for those keeping score at home.
This next one is my personal favorite bird. If you're going to see it, you're probably going to see it like in a clear cut or kind of open area surrounded by forest. They're going to be up high singing.
The last part of that call sounded familiar.
They're bright blue.
Okay, bluebirds?
No.
No, blue jay. No, that's not a blue jay. I know that call. Bright blue, not a bluebird, not
they're
a blue jay.
They're migrant.
Why can I not bring this to the top of my brain right now?
Indigo bunting. They're so beautiful. They're my favorite bird. I get so excited every time I see one. All right, I'm going to end you on another easy one.
You keep calling these easy. Man.
Probably another one you see in your backyard.
Yeah, that right there. I hear that all the time. House finch?
Carolina Wren.
Golly, I answered that.
It's very hard.
I was
right
before saying that, but I was like, I said that one earlier, so I can't be wrong on a Carolina Wren twice.
It's very hard when you don't have those visual cues that you're used to seeing.
We've got a Carolina Wren that nests at our house, and this is the third year running. I just noticed the other day I've got this extension cord that has been coiled up for 3 years hanging in the same spot out by my garden. And she's nested in it the past 2 years, and I just noticed the other day she was building a nest again.
Nice.
Makes me happy, yeah. So, like, now that's her extension cord.
Right.
That's not mine anymore.
Yeah.
My wife's like, so we can't use that. I'm like, you know, Whitney, I mean, we might just have to go get a new one. I don't know. It's hers. She feels safe here. I like that. Like, let's let her ride.
I used to work for a company that had a ton of bluebird boxes, and it was part of my job to, like, check the boxes every couple of days just to see, like, if it had been nested, if there were eggs or chicks in it. And the wrens were always so mad when you came to check on the box. They would nest in the bluebird boxes.
Uh-huh.
They would like dive bomb your head, and so you're just trying to get in and out of there quick because it makes them so upset.
I know, they get really, it's tough because like it, I've noticed this the past 2 years when this female Carolina wren has nested, that like over the month of, because I typically put my seedlings in the ground for my garden, like I usually target April 10th, I'm watching frost. So we're getting close, and we probably will do an episode on that coming up here in the next few weeks. So keep your eyes peeled on an announcement for that. But it's like those first few weeks, probably the first 4 weeks of watering, she's angry. She's flying out of there. Like, she's pissed when I show up to water. And it's funny, usually by about like somewhere between June 1st and June 15th, she just realizes, it's like she remembers again, like, okay, he's just watering. He's not here to bother me. He's not even going to come over near me. And she'll stay in there and like, I'll come to water, and I could see her come to the opening of the nest and stare at me like she's watching me. And I imagine if I got too close, she would probably go back to her old ways of getting angry. But it's always makes me feel nice. I'm like, oh, she's comfortable with me now. Like, we're good. We have an understanding, you know, allowing each other to exist and do our thing.
Yeah. One of the things I love about these little songbirds like wrens and chickadees and those other kind of little ones is they predator mob. So have you ever seen them like swarming a crow or something in your yard?
Mm-hmm. It's
so
amazing.
There's a fun little trick you can do if you're out birding and you know that they're kind of around but you can't see them. You can do what's called pishing, and it basically mimics like the noises they make to each other to say, hey, somebody's here, we got to get on this. And you just give a little psh, 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 psh.
Okay.
And all of a sudden you're just like surrounded. Every little bird around just kind of starts creeping closer and closer to you. You don't do it very often. You don't do it for very long because, again, it's making them think there's a predator around.
Right.
But if you just, like, you're hearing something and you cannot figure it out, you can kind of draw them in a little bit to figure out what's going on.
I'm going to be out trying that, like, this weekend. Thank you.
The first time I introduced that to Addie, she was so excited. And every now and then she'll say, I was pishing at the birds. It's very fun.
So yeah, for those listening, if you ever see us in public, a TRLT staff member making that noise, just mind your business. Keep on going. You know, we're
or
just
come
talking
over
to the birds.
And see what
yeah,
birds
come see what
around.
We're calling in. Yeah. But we're not crazy. We've not lost our minds. We're just talking to the birds.
And if you wanna come out birding with us, be sure to join the upcoming hiking club stuff. Crystal and I are always pointing out what's around.
Absolutely. You guys can check the website for dates on that. I also, while we have Emily here, as we're kind of wrapping up the quiz portion, thank you, by the way, for that. I learned a lot of things I didn't know. Hopefully you guys enjoyed my stumbling over some of those questions and maybe learned a few things you didn't know. But we have something to talk about. The Through Hike is coming up, the spring Through Hike. Registrations are open on the website.
Yeah, registration is open. That is the April 27th through 30th. It's a Thursday to a Saturday. We're starting to fill up. So if you're interested in coming, I would register sooner rather than later.
So I've mentioned it a few times, but since I have you on here, I'm going to press you for details. I'm camp hosting Friday night, but this will be my first Through Hike. So like, what, you know, we start Thursday, where we start at what trailhead and go to what trailhead? And
yeah, so we'll start on Thursday at the 2427, or some people call it the Wood Run trailhead, which is on Highway 2427, kind of right between Troy and Mount Gilead. So we'll have check-in there, you'll get your t-shirt, you'll sign your liability waiver, and you'll hit the trail. And from there, you'll hike to the Yates Place campground.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Where we have some wonderful, wonderful pizza waiting on you, thanks to the URI Trailblazers. They are sponsoring dinner Thursday night. So we'll keep you fed.
Fantastic. So you do. So we do meals every night for the hikers.
We do. So we provide dinner every night. The Land Trust sponsors the big cookout on Saturday night.
Yep.
And then we have some great partners who help cover meals on Thursday and Friday.
Man, that's awesome. So yeah, way less weight to carry if you don't have to carry all that food.
A lot of our hikers say that it's the only backpacking trip you'll go on and gain weight. So we have several aid stations every day where we'll have volunteers who show up with Bojangles biscuits or donuts. And we have all kinds of snacks and candy and all that good stuff to keep people motivated as they're anywhere we have a road crossing or anything like that. We've got an aid station set up for you. Backcountry and Beyond actually sponsors the second aid station on Friday. And people are always so excited to see Jeff there. He usually has solar-powered phone chargers.
Oh, man,
Last year, he had some delicious smoked snack mixes he put on a Traeger and brought for us. And so people are always very excited to see Jeff and the folks at Backcountry and Beyond on Friday.
Yeah, and, you know, for those of you like myself who enjoy a nice cold libation at the end of the day, not to worry. We've spoken with Andy at New Sarum. They're a loyal supporter of the Land Trust. They are going to provide some beer for the cookout again on Saturday night. So we got that covered for you guys. And again, head on over to our website to register for that, to get signed up, to find the dates, to find specifics. We are really excited about it. We hope you guys will come out and join us. Lastly, before we sign off and say goodbye to y'all for the day, we have our raffle ticket sales opening up April 1st. That is getting here quickly. Yesterday, I mentioned Matthew and I drove to Wilmington. We picked up an awesome Jeep that we're going to have in the raffle. We got a Subaru Crosstrek from Strider in Asheboro. We got all kinds of great stuff. Y'all keep an eye on our socials for raffle promotions, for prize promotions. And, you know, we'd love to talk about the prizes and all the awesome stuff that you can win. But really, the main goal here, it's all about conservation. It's all about your money going to support local conservation. It goes to work in your backyard, you know, goes to work on the URI trail, goes to work on nature preserves right here outside of downtown Salisbury and all throughout our 15 county area. So we are hoping you guys will buy, you know, and look, there's no limit on tickets. So I keep mentioning it's $100 ticket as if you may only buy one, but please feel free, buy as many as you would like, increase your odds. And we hope to see you guys at the Through Hike here at the end of the month. And again, and we always say this, if you have any suggestions, any tips, anybody you'd like to see, any subject matter you'd like to see covered on Campfire Conversations, please send me an email, will@trlt.org. Let me know what you want to see, and we'll get it on the docket. So thanks for listening. Thanks for being here. Emily, thank you for being here.
Thank you for being a good sport.
And we'll see you guys next week. Signing off.
If you like the show and would like the episodes to keep coming, you should know that our podcast is just one of the tools that we use at Three Rivers Land Trust to further our conservation mission. Our number one priority and purpose is to conserve land and natural resources for future generations and to be a voice for wildlife and to ensure wildlife populations have habitat forever here in North Carolina. This podcast is just a byproduct to further that mission. You can visit our website at trlt.org to join us in this conservation mission.